The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
So I have a funny story about my guest this week. You probably know who he is. His name is Gary Schilling. He's an economist. He's all over television and print and everything. He's his background, he essentially built the economics department at Merrill Lynch. He was Merrill's first chief economist. And we get into a few stories about that. But I have a really amusing story that we just didn't get to in our conversation. So I have at various times spoken at different events, and this was an event that was down in the Caribbean, they have a lineup of different people, this economist, that market strategist, and you sing for your supper, you speak for an hour or two, and then you get to play in the Caribbean for a few days. So it's a good deal for everybody. And by coincidence, I'm on a catamaran with my wife and Gary Schilling and Gary's wife. And we're going out to do a little diving, a little snorkeling. I want to say it was Anguilla or Antigua, and I never remember which is which. But, you know, at a certain point, all those islands, they're beautiful, it's sunny, the water is gorgeous, and it's hard to tell where you are when you're on a boat for a week or so. So we go out to the dive location, and it's a bright, sunny day, and everything is marked underwater. It's 20 feet, it's 30 feet, it's crystal clear waters. And I have a tendency to even when snorkeling, to like to try and dive deep and look at stuff. And so all of a sudden, a storm comes in out of nowhere. We come up from underwater, and it's absolute from bright blue skies to totally gray. Can't see anything. Can't see more than 10 feet. The boat, which was 50 yards off in that direction, is gone. And I'm a pretty good swimmer, and my wife is starting to panic. What are we going to do? We're stuck here. And I'm like, well, we have two choices. It's the Caribbean. These storms blew in and out in 30 seconds. We could just tread water here and let it pass. Or I'm pretty sure the boat is that way. I have a really good sense of direction. And I said, look, see where these markings are on the floor and where the entrance to this dive site is. Straight line back, that's where the boat is. So we could wait here for 5 minutes, wait for this to pass. We could go back to the boat. She goes, take us back to the boat. Okay. So she grabs onto my waistband and I swim back to the boat, or at least where I think the boat is. And we're swimming for about 7 minutes. And lo and behold, oh, look, there's the outline of a sail. Oh, that's the catamaran. There's the boat. And of course, by the time we get to the catamaran, the skies are clearing. But meanwhile, I assumed it was just myself and my wife swimming back to the boat. We look back, there's a line of 40 people following us, including Gary Schilling and his wife. It was a little nerve-wracking for people who either aren't good swimmers or tend to panic a little bit. And so we all get back on the catamaran, and all of us, the cat then takes us to a cove where the water is 3 feet deep, and we all get rip-roaringly drunk and spend a few hours stumbling along the beach. So that was the first time I spent any time with Gary Schilling. We've since remained friendly, and I've always enjoyed him and his wife. They're fascinating, lovely people. And every year he sends a batch of honey to friends and family that he raises himself. We spend a lot of time talking about beekeeping, which is pretty hilarious conversation. Without further ado, here is my chat with economist Gary Schilling.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio, my special guest is Gary Schilling, an economist and proprietor of the A. Gary Schilling newsletter and economic forecast. A little background about Gary. Got a degree in physics, cum laude, magna cum laude, from Amherst College before getting a master's and a PhD in economics at Stanford. Ended up on the research staff of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco before going on to set up the economics department at a little shop called Merrill Lynch, where he served as the firm's first chief economist. Wow, that's an amazing piece of history. Author of the book, The Age of Deleveraging, twice ranked as Wall Street's top economist, according to Institutional Investor, and a legendary beekeeper. Gary, welcome to Bloomberg.
Very glad to be with you.
So Gary and I know each other for quite a few years. We'll talk about some of our adventures together. But let's start with the beginning. So physics, right? And I keep talking to people on Wall Street with a physics background. How do you go from physics from that to both a master's and a doctorate in economics at Stanford?
Well, I like the discipline of physical sciences, and there is a yearning for closure on things. You want to fit things together. It isn't just kind of a flash here, a flash there. You want to see how things come out in terms of a total. And
take some variables, put them into a formula, and actually derive a conclusion.
That's a little oversimplified, but the whole idea is that there is a discipline to any natural science, physics, chemistry, math, all these things. They don't have quite the fuzziness that economics has. Now, you get into economics, and you know, economic forecasting is an art. It's not a science. But mm-hmm. that discipline, I think, is important because it kind of keeps you on the straight and narrow. But anyway, I started off there, and then my senior year, I had an attack of common sense and decided I wasn't cut out to be a research physicist. So
I had a similar epiphany in my senior year.
So I decided to move on, and you know, it's one of these great developments where I was thinking about going to graduate school in economics, and I talked to Amherst, is a small school, about 1,000 students at the time, and talked to the president of the college, and he suggested business school and a couple of other people, and I talked to the head of the economics department, who I'd happen to have when I had an elementary economics course, and the sections were taught not by graduate students, because there were none, but by the faculty, and we talked about it, and he suggested a couple of places, and then he said, what's your academic record? And I told him, and he said, oh, you can get anywhere you want to go. Where do you want to go? And I said, well, I grew up in Ohio. I'm here in Massachusetts. I've been an allergic since birth. I'd like to get into a decent climate. And he said, well, how about Stanford? And I said, the climate's fine. How about the economics department? He said, oh, it's one of the top two or three in the country. So he called up, set it up. I got a teaching assistantship, a resident assistantship. I never filled out an application. It was one of these things where somebody really did something for me. We all have that went out of his way. And well, as I say, the rest is history.
That's fantastic. So from physics to Stanford, you end up working in Standard Oil, now ExxonMobil.
Correct.
How did that come about, and how did you go from there to finance?
Well, it was interesting. At that time, when I came out of Stanford, my wife and I would like to have stayed on the West Coast. I met her. She was a physiology major at Stanford.
Or in graduate school. Sure. Yeah.
But there were only three places a PhD economist could work in the Bay Area. One was the San Francisco Fed, and I spent a summer there, and that was a pretty laid-back place.
Uh-huh.
The second was Bank of America, when it was Bank of America, California, the Giannini origination. And they sponsored my PhD research, and that wasn't really quite active enough. And the third one was Stanford Research Institute, and they didn't pay anything.
Right.
So I told my wife there were two things I'd never, never do. One is work in New York, and the other is commute to work. Well, that was the beginning of a great forecasting career, because I took a job as an economist with Standard Oil New Jersey, now ExxonMobil, as you pointed out, Barry. And the rest of the story is we lived in a New York apartment for 2 years, moved to the suburbs, commuted for 25 years, but in 1990, I moved our shop out to suburban New Jersey, and it's a mere coincidence. It's 1.4 miles from our house in Short Hills, New Jersey.
Just by coincidence. So let's talk a little bit about your time on Wall Street. You not only were the first economist, chief economist for Merrill Lynch, you actually set up their entire economics department.
Yeah, that's an interesting story because at that point, the bond houses on Wall Street had economists. Henry Kaufman was at Salomon Brothers, Al Wojnarowski at First Boston, Len Santow at Aubrey G. Lampson.
Merrill was known as a stock house back then.
I think I was the first economist at a stock house, Merrill Lynch. And at that point, economists were relatively new. I can remember Bill Freund, who was the economist for the New York Stock Exchange, remains a good friend, and he would have what he called Freund's friends, all the economists from Wall Street, over for monthly lunches at the New York Stock Exchange. And we all fit in comfortably in one of those wonderful ornate rooms. There couldn't have been more than 20 of us. Now, how many dozens, hundreds of economists are there on Wall Street?
Makes a lot of sense. Perhaps it is part of the reason we obsess so much on the day-to-day economic data that seems to come out. I recall a less of an emphasis on that 10, 20 years ago than we see currently.
Well, and of course, there's a difference, too, the data then. I mean, at that point, every economist would have a couple of research assistants. You get the data by mail. They laboriously draw these charts. There were hardly any computers. There were no copy machines. I mean, it was and of course, that made you think a lot more.
You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My guest this week is Gary Schilling, an economist and essentially physicist who produces his own economic research and forecasts. We were discussing earlier that you had helped set up the research department at Merrill Lynch and you were their chief economist. You also, their first chief economist, you
Correct.
Also have the distinction of being the only person to be fired not once, but twice by Donald Regan from Merrill Lynch. Tell us how that came about.
I went there in 1967, and there had not been a recession in the U.S. really since 1960-61. Now, I forecast a recession for 69-70, which did occur, but it was so different from Merrill Lynch because Merrill Lynch at that point, it was buy listed stocks only. That was the whole rationale of the firm. Mm-hmm. And the idea of a recession was very upsetting. So Don Regan, who was running the place, and I had a difference of opinion.
Right.
Obviously, he won. I took my entire staff, left, ended up at White Weld, another Wall Street house, with no idea 1978 Merrill Lynch would buy White Weld. So the story in the street, which is literally true, was Schilling's the only guy fired twice by Don Regan.
So you come back to Merrill when they buy White Weld.
Yeah.
And how does the second firing come about?
Well, I mean,
another recession forecast?
No, that was automatic. As a matter of fact, I found out later that when Regan, the first meeting between Don Regan and Paul Hallingby, who was head of White Weld, that Regan said, if we get together, I want it known that there's one employee of White Weld who will not be invited to join the combined firm. So I was out before
hilarious.
I got in.
So,
but anyway, that was the inducement to do what I really had in mind, which was set up my own firm.
Launch your own firm. So before we go to that, I want to talk about life at a big shop in the late 60s or 70s. What was it like as a chief economist at Merrill Lynch back in the day?
It was a lot of fun in many ways. They had a very good sales staff, particularly the institutional salesmen. These guys were hungry for input. I was very willing to trot all over the world, not only the U.S. but Europe and Japan, and it was great working for these guys. Of course, they would really get their money's worth. I remember one salesman, Minneapolis. Where this guy had scheduled meetings with institutions every hour on the hour throughout the day. I went to the lunch meeting, and I get my fork ready for the first bite of lunch, and he says, "Well, Gary, tell us about the economy." And so the entree comes and goes, the dessert comes and goes. We rush out there to the next one, and I say, "Wait a minute, I didn't get anything to eat." He says, "Don't worry, I got a sandwich. You can eat it on the elevator on the way down."
But, so they kept you hopping as an adjunct to institutional sales. So you leave Merrill almost the second time and set up your own shop. You have your own models and your own forecasting setup that you put together. Let's talk a little bit about the economy and economic indicators and what goes into your process.
Right.
What do you think are the most important economic indicators? What do you follow and think has the most resonance?
Well, let me say this, Barry, just going into this, that as I mentioned earlier, forecasting, in my view, is an art. It's not a science. Now, I was trained as an econometrician. When I got to Stanford, I'd had, you know, if you're a physics major, you're a math major, too, whether you want to be or not.
Right.
And I was working there under Ken Arrow, Nobel Prize winner,
sure,
econometrician. And I'd had only one undergraduate economics course. So the math side, the econometric side was easy. The economic stuff I had to learn. But I have found less and less interest in these big models. They simply do not work. They blow up. They produce nonsensical solutions.
Why is that? Are they too complex, or are the underlying assumptions false?
You know, that's a very good question, and I don't think anybody has really ever completely answered that. But
I thought I just did.
But the problem is you have to keep going in and plugging in, and by the time you get all through, you might as well—
Exceptions and variances.
You might as well do it from scratch. But at that time, there was this hope that somehow you could devise a model of the economy. It would be unsullied by human hands. You put in the inputs and out comes the solution, and that's all you need to know. So now forecasting, in my view, is a whole combination of things, and it really can't be quantified in any precise way. It's certainly looking at various leading indicators. What's the Federal Reserve?
What leading indicators do you think are most important?
What's the Federal Reserve doing or not doing? What's the state of consumers? Right now, we think we're in this age of deleveraging, working off excess debt from the 80s and 90s. And that, you know, I put out this book, The Age of Deleveraging, in 2010, and I said I thought we were going to have 2% real GDP growth. And, of course, the Fed and most people said, oh, no, it's going to pick up. Well, where are we? 2.2% since this recovery started in the middle of 09. But it's looking at history. It's Kentucky windage. It's a whole host of things.
Kentucky windage.
Yeah.
What is Kentucky windage?
That's a Midwestern term for hunches.
Okay, Kentucky windage. I like that.
Well, that's when you're shooting. You know, and those guys were really sharp. They were really sharp.
So they're just taking a guess.
Well,
as
you
the
have to know. You
the...
have to know the wind, because a wind pushes the bullet
a little bit.
Oh yeah,
left or right.
Matter of fact, I talked to a friend of mine who was trained as a sniper, and I called him up after I seen this movie, the American Sniper.
Sure.
And I asked him about that, and he explained that shot that guy made when he took out the bad guy. He said that was impossible, because the sandstorm was coming up.
The 1,000-yard.
And with the winds going in and out of the buildings, it would cause the bullet to drift. And even with all the power of that 50 caliber rifle,
you're still going to get some
drift.
He
said that shot was not possible.
I have a T-shirt I have to dig up somewhere a buddy gave me, who was a Marine sharpshooter. Their logo, their tagline was, "Why run? You'll only die tired." These guys are serious, serious shooters, and they calculate all that stuff, everything from curvature of the earth to wind drift. It's all part of it.
Oh, yeah.
So let's hold off discussing the economy itself to a later segment. Let's talk a little bit about what goes into some of these models and what goes into some of the forecasts. What do you look at? So you mentioned interest rates. You mentioned consumer spending. What other factors do you think are really significant?
Well, what's also very important is what is the consensus saying? Because
in order to push back against or to see where they're wrong?
Yeah. I have two basic principles that have always been guiding me. One is that human nature changes very slowly over time, so people react to similar circumstances in similar ways. In other words, history is relevant. Now, you still have to find the right piece of history. Mark Twain says history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. And the second one is that you don't add value by rehashing the consensus. It doesn't mean you are contrarian and then you buck the consensus regardless. Where we agree, we pass over it lightly, but where we find something that's important is likely to happen, because you're judged by your forecasting record ultimately. And third is not yet within the purview of the consensus. That's where we really get interested.
This week on Masters in Business, I'm speaking with economist Gary Schilling, noted author and forecaster and physicist for that matter, as well as an economist. Right out of school, you spent some time in the San Francisco Federal Reserve office. What was that experience like?
Well, it was really at that point deciding that, at least at that time, it was a pretty sleepy operation. So I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what indicators led the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
that was a stupid
exercise, because, you know, you think about it, the stock market tends to lead almost anything else. And if you could find something that consistently does the stock market, hey, you'd make a fortune. So that was, but that was a learning experience. That's what happens when you're young and naive.
So let me ask you a related question then. What indicators do people tend to obsess about that really don't matter all that much?
Well, it changes over time, but right now the Fed is pretty much irrelevant in my view. I mean, you're looking at a period where the Fed has pushed out all this money, quantitative easing. Mm-hmm. It hasn't done much good. Why is that? Well, it's very simple. Basically, that money got into circulation, and people use it to buy assets, stocks.
Right.
But stocks are owned principally by high-income people who don't adjust their spending much in relation to their assets. You got three cars in the driveway. You're not going to put a fourth one in there. So it never got beyond that, and it didn't do much to help the basic economy. It's the pushing on a string, the Keynesian liquidity trap. You can use all the technical terms.
Right.
But basically, the Fed is, in my view, is pretty much irrelevant. And also, of course, in this slow growth period, the Fed keeps pushing off the day that they're going to raise rates. They're now a lot more concerned with the rest of the world. Their charter is strictly domestic, full employment and price stability. But they obviously now are expanding that because the rest of the world is a global economy. But I think all in all, the Fed is pretty impotent right now. It doesn't make much difference what they do.
So what has been the impact of zero interest rate policy? What's been the impact of QE on the overall economy?
The effect of QE on the overall economy has been surprisingly little. To say it has pushed up asset prices, but you haven't gotten the multiplier effect. Normally, when the Fed gives the banks a dollar in reserves, by lending and relending in what's called a fractional reserve system, they turn it into $70 of M2 money, 70.
Right.
This point.
70 to 1. That's 70 the
to 1, right.
Effect.
Now it's 1.4 to 1.
So barely moving.
Barely moving. And so it really hasn't had much effect. So the Fed is really I think pretty much on the sidelines. And the other thing about the quantitative easing is that the effects of this lower interest rates, it's created a lot of distortions, a lot of zeal for yield. You see the rush into leveraged loans, into emerging market debt and equity, into commodities, into hedge funds, and so on. Pension funds is still cling to the idea of 8% returns on their portfolios. They say, we can't get that in conventional stocks and bonds. We're going to get it some way. So they move out on the risk curve. And I think a lot of them have moved a lot further out on the risk curve than they realize.
I still don't understand where this 8% number has come from. It seems like they've made that number up and that they want 8%. Look, in order to maintain a tax deferred status, it's 5% is what you have to put out. So I don't know where this number came from.
I think maybe, Barry, it was 5% plus 3% for inflation.
There you go.
But
you don't have inflation
that. You know, you haven't got any inflation. But, of course, the other thing is if they start lowering that number, then they have to lower the other side, the discounting rate for the future liabilities, the pension payments, to bring it back to the present value. And that greatly increases, you know, the lower the interest rate you're discounting with, that greatly expands the current value of those liabilities. So they get hit on both sides. So there's a great reluctance to face reality.
To be honest about what they should really be expecting
post-crisis. That's correct.
That's quite fascinating. So let's talk a little bit about what should have been done. Following the financial crisis, what should Congress have done? What should the Federal Reserve have done in response to, you know, the collapse in asset prices and GDP and jobs?
Well, bailing out Wall Street probably was necessary because we very well could have had a full-blown financial meltdown.
What about bailing out the bondholders? When we talk about these bailouts, a lot of bad bonds were paid out 100 cents on the
dollar. Yeah, that's right. And I think that really has prolonged the agony. I think they probably went too far on this whole process.
Tear the Band-Aid off, some bad debt go.
And they really have way overrated themselves in terms of what they can do. Look at the whole effects. $1 trillion deficits, huge quantitative easing, and what do we get? 2% real GDP growth. I mean, it's telling you that these forces of deleveraging are so great they're overpowering this. And these guys who constantly think that policy is going to overwhelm everything else and they're going to get the results they want, I think they're in a dream world.
You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. My guest today is Dr. Gary Schilling. He is an economist, researcher, forecaster. Let's talk a little bit about the present economy. Where are we in the economic cycle?
I'm not sure we're in a conventional economic cycle. And, of course, everybody wishes we were. Everybody yearns for the idea of a very systematic cycle. And you can say, where are you? I go out and I see presentations. A lot of the big banks have their representatives out and they say, oh, here's a circle and here's where we are and that. I don't think we're in that kind of world right now. We're going through this massive deleveraging. We're seeing slow growth. We're seeing commodity prices decline. We're seeing the strength in the dollar. We're seeing competitive devaluations against the dollar. There's a lot of things going on here that I don't think give you a very clear idea of a cycle per se. And one thing I think is you know, there's this yearning for nostalgia. We all have that. Mm-hmm. And forecasters are just as subject to this as anybody else. And you always have this feeling, oh, boy, if we could get back to the days when it was a nice cycle. And I know that it's 4 years. And
if I could weigh 175 pounds, I'd be thrilled to death.
Yeah. But, you know, and people talk about equilibrium. Hey, I've been in this business a long time, Barry, and equilibrium is something you simply pass through on the way to going to excesses on the top or the bottom.
That's exactly
It doesn't exist.
Fair value, you exist at very briefly you're swinging.
And only in retrospect.
That's right. So along those lines, let me ask you a related question. I know you're a historian. I know you look at a lot of economic data from days gone by. Is there any period in history that's comparable to what we're living through now?
That's a good question. At times when you're working off excesses, I suppose you could say that to a certain extent that's what was going on in the 1930s.
Mm-hmm. But post Great Depression, even in the Great
Post-crash. Yeah, that was the Great Depression, the aftermath. But there were a lot of other things going on there. Mm-hmm. A complete shift in policy from basically a laissez-faire to much more government involvement in the economy. Whether that helped or hurt, historians argue about that. I don't think there is a period right now where you can point to it and say, let's follow the script. That does happen from time to time, and mm-hmm. I'm always looking for those periods because
this is unique, you're saying.
Yeah, I don't see the relevance of that right now.
Can you say this is unprecedented? There's nothing else.
Well, at least I think in experience of modern economic forecasting it is.
Mm-hmm. So I know you're a big bond bull and have been for a long time.
We've 34 had years.
34-year bull market in bonds showing no sign of ending. Where are we in this bond? Is the bond bull market still alive?
Yeah, 1981, the yield on the 30-year treasury was 15.21%. And I said in writing, we're entering the bond rally of a lifetime because I saw inflation unwinding, and with lower inflation, that would push down yields, push up bond prices. And I think we're still in that. I mean, yields now obviously have dropped a tremendous amount. They're more like under 3% for the 30-year bond. I think we're going to go to 2%.
Now somebody says, the 30-year bond?
Yeah, on the 30-year bond.
That's amazing.
Now somebody says, well, I mean, what does that do for you? And who would accept 3% yield? I couldn't care less what the yield is. I never have, as long as it's going down. Because that means the price of the bonds is going
right up.
And when you look at the convexity of this whole thing, if I'm right and you go from essentially 3% to 2% on a 30-year coupon bond, you make 30% on your money, which I think is going to be a lot better than whatever is in second place.
And my mortgage is going to drop to 2.9%. What does that do for housing? What does that do for other items purchased with debt?
Well, of course, the question is, under what circumstance does that happen? If you're mm-hmm. in a very low inflationary environment, if you're in a slow growth. Yeah. If you're in a slow growth environment, it has other characteristics. I mean, you look at housing. You mentioned housing. Housing, this recovery has been basically a rental market. Mm-hmm. It has not been new homeowners that normally are the basis of housing. They're the people that buy the starter houses from people that then move up the next rung on the ladder and on up. In housing.
Not really happening this
time. No, because people, they don't have the incomes, they don't have the credit scores, and of course it's become, it's become a virtue of, as out of necessity. People, I really don't want a house of my own. I don't want the responsibility. I'd rather live in a more urban environment. Chicken and egg there.
Right.
Which way is the causality?
But my friend Jonathan Miller, who's been on the show, does a lot of interesting appraisal analysis, said that there are so many people with either low equity, no equity, or negative equity that a huge pool of inventory that's normally for sale isn't on the market, and a huge pool of potential buyers aren't participating. So you have few buyers and even fewer houses.
Yeah, and there are a lot of people, you know, it's just like stocks. The idea they take a beating in a stock and they say, I won't sell it till I get out even. It's irrational because the market is whatever the market is today. Mm-hmm. But I think there is that pool of people who own houses. They bought them, they're underwater, and they're basically saying, yeah, I want to sell, but I can't get out from under it. And of course, some people, they have, you know, they're upside down. The mortgage is worth more than the house. Mm-hmm. So if they sell it, they've got financial problems.
To say the least. It also depends if you're in a recourse or a non-recourse state, if you can walk away or not, or if you can talk your bank into renegotiating the total amounts under a number of the HAMP and TAMP programs.
Oh, sure.
You could
do a short sale where you basically sell to market and the lender forgives the difference. I mean, there are all kinds of variations.
So what do you see happening in housing over the next couple of years?
Well, I think housing is probably going to limp along here, but I don't see anything really pushing it. I mean we're the most overhoused country in the world, possible exception maybe Spain. I mean, the National Association of Realtors would never tell you that, but
it's always a good time to buy or sell a house, according to them.
Yeah, I remember an ad they had back
in the peak.
It says it's a great time to buy, it's a great time to sell.
It's always a great time to have it both ways. Right, always a great time to generate a sales commission.
Yeah, you got it, man.
So let's talk about energy, because you've sent some really interesting things about energy. Oil prices have dropped, cut in half over the past year. I understand you talked about $20 a barrel oil.
Yeah, well, here's the rationale. OPEC is a cartel. Cartels exist to keep prices above equilibrium. That's the whole purpose.
Mm-hmm.
That encourages cheating. Somebody wants more than their share, either in the cartel, OPEC, or outside. Russia, American frackers, whoever. So the leader of the cartel's responsibility is to cut its own production to accommodate the cheaters, to avoid a price collapse. Well, OPEC's been doing that for years, but they're getting tired of it. In the last 10 years, OPEC production has been flat, and all the growth has come in non-OPEC sources, a lot of it recently from American mm-hmm. frackers. So the Saudis and their colleagues in the Persian Gulf, back November 27th, when we were sitting down to our Thanksgiving turkeys, they decided they weren't going to cut. They basically said, we're going to play an elaborate game of chicken. We got about $500 billion in foreign currency reserves, and we're going to see who can take lower prices the longest. OPEC production was 30 million barrels a day. They took off the quotas. It's now 31.5 million barrels a day. So you say, okay, now how low do prices go before somebody chickens out? Some major producer says, I've had it.
Uncle.
I've got to cut back. It isn't the cost of meeting budgets. That's irrelevant here. Okay, maybe Venezuela is $150 a barrel. That's irrelevant. It isn't even the full cycle cost. In other words, the cost of drilling the hole, laying the pipes, the overhead, and so on. No. When you're a price war, it's the marginal cost. It's the mm-hmm. cost once the pipes are laid, the oil is coming out of the ground. In other words, where does your free cash flow disappear? And in the Permian Basin in Texas and in the Persian Gulf, that's in the $10 to $20 a barrel range. So that's how I get to that number.
So you can actually see oil fall down to $25 or so a barrel, and they're still making $5 or more for each barrel they pull out of the ground.
That's right. In other words, they may be losing money on a full cost basis, but in terms of the marginal cost, in other words, you know, they still have positive cash flow on a marginal basis. So that's the incentive to keep producing. And now, you know, price goes down there, it doesn't stay there forever. But you got to get to the point that you have major production that disappears from the system.
And we haven't seen that. The world is awash in oil
today. Oh, sure. I mean, you're producing about 2 million barrels a day more than demand right now.
There are ships floating around filled with oil and no place to drop it off.
Yeah, that's right.
That's quite fascinating. So normally when you talk about oil prices dropping from over $100 to $20, $25, we would be talking about a recession. Do you see a recession anytime in the next 12 months?
I don't see the making of a recession. You have recessions, at least historically, for two reasons. One is the Fed raises interest rates to choke off what they see as an overheating economy. Now, they may have painted themselves into a corner here. They've been yelling and screaming about raising rates. They're crying wolf an awful lot. Their credibility is at stake. They may raise rates simply to preserve credibility. But the kind of interest rate like they did in 94 where they went up 300 basis points on, on Fed funds in 6 months or so. I don't see that. So the other possibility of recession is some kind of a shock.
Right.
That's what we had with a collapse in dot-com stocks in the late 90s. That was a housing in the mid-2000s. Maybe China.
So in the last minute we have, you reading my mind, what's the potential impact of China on the global economy?
Well, the reality of China is that nothing has really changed there except perceptions. China basically is not a leader. It's not a self-led country. China imports raw materials and equipment and use it to manufacture goods that they send to North America and Europe.
So their activity follows the rest of the world's economic activity.
That's right. They are dependent on that. Of course, they have infrastructure spending as well. But the point is that China, it's the perception of China with a collapse in stock prices and the devaluation. People are suddenly saying, oh, my God, China isn't really independently growing. They haven't been for years, but perceptions have reality. And will that have enough follow-on consequences with effects on commodity prices and currencies and other developing countries? That's what's there. And that's if there is a recession out there in the next 12 months or so, I think that's probably where it would be generated.
Thank you to my guest, Gary Schilling, for spending so much time with us. Be sure and check out our podcast extras where we continue the conversation. Check out my daily column on BloombergView.com. Follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio. Okay, so this is the podcast portion of the show where I stop worrying about the time segments and we could chat about anything. Okay. Before, and I know I have to get you out of here at a certain time, but that'll be easy. Before we start talking about some other the questions that we've missed and some other stuff, these are all my questions, I have to ask you about the beekeeping. You're famous on Wall Street for being a beekeeper and mailing out honey to various people as holiday presents.
Yeah, yeah.
Including myself. I have a tub of honey, and I believe and you have a different inscription every year, and the one that stands out was, the Fed's funny money can't buy this honey.
Yeah, this year, as Treasury bonds soar, our bees make more.
There you go.
We always try to find something topical and usually related to the financial sector.
How on earth did you get into beekeeping?
Well, it's an interesting story. We live in suburban New Jersey, and I have a bunch of dwarf fruit trees around our premises, and I didn't think they were getting pollinated properly. And I had this—
Based on what? What makes you wake up one day and say, I'm not sure our fruit trees are being properly—
Lots of blossoms and not that much
fruit. Not a lot of fruit. Okay. That makes sense.
All right. Very simple road test. Anyway— I had this romantic idea of putting in some beehives, and my wife kept saying, come on, this is no farm, this is suburbia. Well, then our third son, who was an animal lover since birth, did his senior college thesis on bees, and that's all it took to push me over the edge. So one afternoon when my
wife— He does his college thesis unprompted from you, unprovoked? Complete coincidence.
No, totally independent. No, there was no leading the witness on that one.
Okay.
So he's doing this, and so he and I smuggle in a couple of hives one afternoon when
how
my
big?
Wife was
what,
out.
What, what's the, how physically?
Well, the hive is the box.
They're vertical, essentially.
Well, you stack them up. You stack up the boxes, but the box, the dimensions are 16 and 5/8 inch wide, 19 and 7/8 inch long, and they're varying depths. Mm-hmm. And I can explain to you why the dimensions
are.
Okay, this is very interesting. Bees have been kept since time immemorial.
Millennia.
By the way, honey never spoils.
Never spoils, that's
they've
right.
taken it out of ancient Egyptian tombs, which is just as good as the day the bees made it.
Really?
Yeah.
I had no idea. Now, I know it was good for a long time. I didn't know it was good that long.
Now, throughout this time, though, they had bees. They were in various cavities and so on. There's what's called a skeps, which is a series of kind of concentric rings. If you've ever seen Utah road sign, mm-hmm. the Beehive State, that's a skeps. You know, it's a traditional kind of—
Those round sort
yeah,
of
Yeah, round
stacked.
Kind of thing. And the bees would be in there, and when they left to their own devices, the bees make— It has a hexagonal cells, but they look
honeycomb.
Like stalactites
right.
hanging down. Well, the way they harvested the honey was they basically killed the hive.
Right.
They would use sulfur smoke, kill the hive, and then crush the combs to get the honey out.
Well, that's not
good. Well, that was very inefficient because they had to have about twice as many hives as they were going to harvest. And also, after the advent of kerosene, that's Colonel Drake drilling as well, for lights, there was not the need for beeswax for candles.
Mm-hmm.
So wax, and it takes about 10 times as much nectar to make a pound of wax as a pound of honey.
Mm-hmm.
So this is very inefficient. In 1851, now honeybees are from the old, all from the old world. They came here with the European settlers. The Indians called them the white man's fly. But a congregational preacher in Philadelphia named Lorenzo Langthroff made a very interesting observation. He noticed that the bee would only build, and it's the worker bees that do all this, the drones don't do anything. She would only build her comb within about 3/8 of an inch of any other solid object, including another comb.
Huh.
So he developed from that what's called a movable frame hive. Our listeners may have seen
those stacks that
these
come
frames.
Out. Yep.
In other words, he put these in there, and the bees they built out the wax comb, fill them with honey, put a cap on there. You can take them out, scratch off the caps, put in a centrifuge, spin them out, and put them back.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now coming back to the dimensions, he's the father of modern beekeeping, and those dimensions that I mentioned, 16 5/8 wide, 19 7/8 long, those were the dimensions of some scrap lumber he had. It wasn't a conversion from metric, but he was so influential that became. Now it's a convenient size, but the guy never made a dime out of this because it was so easy to copy.
That's amazing.
But you have these boxes are various depths. There's usually two boxes on the bottom that the bees live in year round, and they have their honey to get through the winter. They have their brood in there, and they have pollen, which is the nectar they feed to the larva. And those boxes, 9 5/8 deep, if they're full of honey, they weigh 85 pounds.
Wow.
So the ones you stack up on top are called supers, and that's the honey we're going to take off. And they're not as deep, so you can lift them. Because try lifting 85 pounds at shoulder height. It's good for the stomach muscles.
My dog weighs 85 pounds. One of my dogs weighs 85 pounds. And I know when I had to carry him, I know 85 pounds ain't easy to lift. So that's amazing. So,
it started off.
You've been doing this how many decades now?
Yeah, well, it started off in 1990. And anyway, this son, Steve, he took off for a job in the Eurodollar pits in the Chicago Merck. And I'd just been the flunky. He was a beekeeper. And it was like, if you ever driven with somebody repeatedly to the same destination, they do the driving, you don't pay any attention.
Right.
That was me. He takes off. I'm instantly promoted to head beekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I guess by then we were up to about 20 hives. And
so how much space is this physically taking in the backyard?
Well, I've got 15 of them in our residence in Short Hills, New Jersey, and I've got about 100.
In your residence
I've got 100,
or on the grounds?
Underground.
Okay.
Underground, in a corner of the property.
Right.
But I got about 100 hives total, and most of
Where are the rest of the hives?
Well, they're more further out in Morristown, New Jersey area, and then I've got some. We have a beach house on Fire Island, some out there.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, you know, this thing, Barry, it just keeps growing, and it's very labor intensive. I got a guy on my staff who spends a lot of time working with me on this.
You're talking about the bees' labor or your labor?
Well, both. I didn't intend the thing to grow, but the damn thing just keeps growing.
How many pounds of honey do you generate
each year? Well, this year we took off 2,500 pounds, and that's
one pound jar. And change of honey.
Yeah, and we give it all away.
Right.
If I ever sold any, I'd have to keep the books, and I don't want to make myself cry because my time would be probably worth a quarter an hour and probably with a minus sign in front of it. But it varies tremendously. Last year was our best year ever, 5,400 pounds. And we still
almost
have
3 tons of honey.
Oh, yeah. We have it stacked all over the office. And my admin, Beth Grant, she keeps saying, come on now, we don't need this much honey. I think she really hopes we don't have a great year because she's trying to figure out where we're going to have it.
So,
we got it stacked all over the place.
So how has these colony collapse diseases been impacted your hive?
That's probably one of the biggest misconceptions. In 2007, 60 Minutes, the TV show did this segment on colony collapse disorder.
Right.
Now, what that means is the bees leave the hive, and they can't live long on their own outside. That's
right.
Clear. They don't come back. And they said this is the end of the world. Well, it's
right.
Actually
no more food pollination.
Yeah, right,
no
right.
more
and,
this.
And
no
about
more that.
About a third of everything we eat depends on insect pollination, and 99 and 44 100% of that is from honeybees. In any event, they said it's the end of the world. Well, what they didn't really, they didn't do their homework, because this is a reoccurring problem. It's about every 25 years. The first observation of this country was 1869.
Oh, really? That's fascinating.
It's on the way now. It's not the problem. But there are other serious problems.
Such as?
Yeah. Well, and as a matter of fact, they just had a huge study announced last year, all the big-name USDA entomologists and the guys from the big schools where they're like Cornell and University of Maryland and Penn State and UC Davis and so on. And they came up with three areas, and everybody's waiting with bated breath for what's the problem with bees? How do we get out of this?
Well, the first one has to be pesticide was what everyone was thinking.
No, that's interesting. It isn't.
No, but that's the first guess everybody's having.
Pesticides, they said maybe, but they're not at all sure. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, their European counterparts were absolutely positively convinced it was pesticides. And 2 months ago, these Europeans said, we're not so sure.
Can't find
But that's
proof.
One. The second one is nutrition.
Really?
Farmers plant fence row to fence row, and there's not a lot of wildflowers to give bees the nectar and pollen that they need. So what they're doing is they're encouraging
fence row to fence row, meaning it's all cash crops.
Yeah, it's
and
all
not,
cash crops.
Nothing decorative
and
like
most of them don't tend to have any nectar that or pollen that's interested to the bees. But what they're doing now, a lot of cases, is they're encouraging farmers to use marginal land to plant. There's an outfit, for example, called Pheasants Unlimited. Mm-hmm. They're in the upper Midwest, and they basically raise pheasants and quail for hunters. And what they do is they provide the seed to farmers, and the nectar and pollen are good for the bees, and then the seeds, the chicks, the pheasants and the quail chicks eat it, mm-hmm. which makes them better to be harvested by the hunter. So
that's fascinating, because there is a farm near where I live, which is where I get my peach raspberry pies, called Young's Farm, and I noticed they have rows and rows of plantings, and then along the edge, which is adjacent to the street, probably not harvestable, they have just a whole run of wildflowers.
Yeah, that's what's being done, and that's helpful. But it's not on a big enough scale. Then the third problem, which is probably the most interesting, is a parasitic mite called varroa, V-A-R-R-O-A.
I read something about this.
Now, this is there are five races of honeybees.
Mm-hmm.
The only one that's commercially valuable is the Latin, the scientific name is Apis mellifera, Apis B. mellifera honey. Now that one originated. Oh, bees are all from the old world. This one originated in southern Europe and the Middle East. There's another race in the Southeast Asia called Apis serena, and this varroa mite is indigenous on Apis serena, and this varroa mite hangs on the bees, sucks out their equivalent of blood. Apis serena recognizes this as the bad guy, and they groom them off each other. They pull them off each other. It jumped over to Apis mellifera.
And they haven't adapted.
And they don't understand it's the bad guy.
Huh.
So
they co-evolved together, and that's how they managed to put whoever figured out we need to take this off. Now we see their offspring around. If you didn't co-evolve, you may not have developed that behavior.
Right now you've got to treat with chemicals. Or absolutely positively, that hive will be dead in 2 years. Now,
really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you don't treat until you take off the honey that we're going to eat, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But they're doing some interesting things. Monsanto has some interesting work where they
kill the mites but leave the bees.
Yeah,
okay.
See, you're trying to kill one insect without killing another insect.
Right.
And they're using some genetic modifications to basically, in effect, try to disrupt the breeding cycle of the mites.
Mm-hmm.
That's in the experimental stage, but that's probably the greatest thing. But this is a serious problem. And the thing is, these mites mutate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the treatments that worked just beautifully 10 years ago aren't worth anything because they mutated, and the ones now are...
Sounds like penicillin-resistant...
Oh, sure.
How did you get from – it's amazing how – first of all, you've obviously studied this in great detail. But as an economist, I don't really think of the next logical step as, well, Of course, beekeeping should be part and parcel
with
that.
Well, there are common threads there, Barry, and
such as let's see.
Well, the one that is not common but I like is it's good physical exercise, and particularly on a nice day, I like to be outside, and you don't get a lot of that when you're sitting behind your desk or on the lecture circuit or whatever.
But you see the distribution of labor amongst the hives. That's got to be an entire
But the other interesting thing is that this. With all these diseases and pests that have beset honeybees in the last couple of decades, it is there is a whole logic, deductive logic sequence I go through when I open a hive. I open a hive, I'm looking, I'm listening, I'm smelling. Is there a queen there? Is she laying? If not, what do I do? I come home from a day in the bee yards out with the bees. I'm wrung out not only physically but mentally. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't think that, but it is. And beekeepers tend to be above average intellect. Mm-hmm. You've got to have a natural curiosity because – and another interesting –
economists, just average intellect. So basically, you're saying that the beekeeping is a greater intellectual challenge than the economic
forecasting. No, I'm not
forecasting.
Saying greater, but it's a different –
That's what I'm hearing. Anyone can be an economist, but to be a beekeeper –
you and I know economics is plenty, but it's a divergence. It's
right.
It's sort of a – You know, I'm the type of guy, I always work, I just change the venue. And that's what it amounts to, where you're shifting gears to something else, but you're still going through that mental process of trying to figure out what's going on there. It's like the economy. You're trying to put all that we talked about this earlier. You're trying to put all these pieces together and see where you come out. And you never can be certain. And beekeeping, hey, the vicissitudes of nature are tremendous. You do everything you possibly can. It's just like a forecast. You cover all the bases, and you're left a certain amount of luck.
Some randomness. You know, I just was speaking at a conference, and the exact same conversation came up with you do X and Y and Z. They all seem so different. And my answer was, they're really the same thing. You look at a variety of ambiguous inputs, try and figure out what matters and what doesn't, and reach a reasonable conclusion within the context. Beekeeping and economics, apparently the same basic, the process is what's so similar, even though it's such totally different.
That's
quite fascinating. So earlier we were talking a little bit about what it was like when you were a researcher at Merrill Lynch and a researcher at the Federal Reserve. What are some of your commentaries or research forecasts that you're especially proud of that really have stood the test in time or may have been unusually contrarian? What stands out to you?
Well, I think the greatest call I made was this one I made in 1981 when I said
bond bull market.
Yeah, that we're entering the bond rally of a lifetime. And
was that a lonely call? Were there other people saying that?
Barry, it was so lonely. I wrote my first book in 1982.
Title?
The title was, Is Inflation Ending? Are you ready? My answer to the first question, yes, inflation is ending. We're going into a period of lower and lower inflation because my view is that government excess spending is the root of inflation. The Fed may be the handmaiden in implementing it, but it's the government spending. And we saw a revolt against government starting with Proposition 13 in California in 1978 and then Reagan's election in 1980. And I said from that inflation was on the way out. And as a result, we were and so the answer to the second half of the question, are you ready? No, because everybody was betting on inflation. They had all their tangibles in their portfolios, coins, antiques, artwork, gold, et cetera. And I said, no, you don't have enough stocks or bonds because they will benefit from this. Now, that was a very lonely call. That book, McGraw-Hill finally got it out in 1982.
Good timing.
But inflation really peaked in 1980. But nobody believed it. The sales of the book were an absolute disaster. As a matter of fact, McGraw-Hill gave us the last couple of thousand copies. They didn't want them. But interesting, in 1986, by then it was clear that inflation was fading. There were two ex post reviews. One was in the Boston Globe, and the other was the Seattle Post Intelligencer. Mm-hmm. And they both, these business editors, they said, and I saw this book, and my God, it was happening. And so they wrote reviews. Well, of course, that was as handy as a pocket in your underwear because the book was long out of print.
Right.
But it was a Pyrrhic victory. But yeah, I mean, that was very lonely. I don't think there was anybody else, at least notable known forecaster, who was saying anything like that at the time.
So let me push back about your claim that it's the government spending and deficits that cause inflation. We have a $19 trillion federal deficit, and yet inflation is non-existent and going lower.
Yeah, I have to fill that out and say it depends on the rest of the economy. If you have an overemployed economy to start with, and then you put all that government spending on top of it, but what you see, that's what happened in the late 60s and 70s.
Very different today.
You had huge government spending on war on poverty and war in Vietnam. And that really strained resources.
On top of a 20-year private sector bull market following the end of World War II.
Generated all that inflation. Well, again, you got the reversal of that starting in...
So now we have the retiring boomers.
Yeah.
We have a whole lot of underemployment, people working part-time who'd rather work full-time. What else do we have in this environment? You have increased globalization.
Well, yeah, globalization, yeah. I think that's been the greatest change in the last 30 years is globalization. And
so let's talk about globalization, but I also want to get to... increased productivity and increased automation as other factors that are driving this. So what has been the impact of globalization on wages both here in the U.S. and worldwide?
Well, it's a great equalizer of wages, obviously. It was very interesting. This goes back years ago. Milton Friedman had read one of my books. He was in San Francisco. He invited me in. He was in an apartment there, greeted me at the door. Hadn't shaved in 3 days, had a bathrobe on. We sat there for about 3 hours talking about inflation and wages. And of course, for
what
him,
year was this?
Oh gosh, this was about the mid 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And his point, of course, is that free markets govern everything. That there's nothing else but. And I was saying, well, you know, wages. Here you've got $20 an hour. You know, for the UAW, I think, in this country, and $2 an hour in Mexico. And I said, you know, you think these are going to equate. Well, they have come a lot closer. And that's what's happened is that this is globalization. And, of course, you had a lot of American labor which was enjoying the fruits of basically isolation. I mean, we did not have global competition. But that's
clearly changed today.
Yeah, that's clearly changed. And so what it means is that we simply cannot compete in basic manufacturing or anything, even services. You know, you talk about doing routine legal services. They do that in India, any place they speak English, mm-hmm. call centers, and so on. So globalization has been a very, very important factor, and we're dealing with the aftermath of that right now.
So let's along those lines, let's talk about demographics and retiring baby boomers. What does that mean for the overall economy? What does that mean for job possibilities and wages?
Well, what's interesting about that is that people are retiring. As a matter of fact, the reason the unemployment rate has come down is basically the people dropping out of the labor force.
What percentage of the fall from 10-point-whatever to 5.1% unemployment is people leaving the labor force?
Well, let's put it this way. If you hadn't had this participation rate, which is anybody 16 and over who's either working or actively looking for work, if you hadn't had that decline from the peak in February of 2000, the unemployment rate today would be 13%.
So that 5%. Many people have left the workforce, are still of working age.
Well, no. That's everybody. Now we've done a lot of work on that. And about 60% of that are people retiring, the post-war babies retiring.
Right.
But 40% are middle-aged people who've said, you know, I can't find a job. And, of course, a lot of younger people who said, I'm going to stay in college. I hope I get a better job. Of course, a lot of them came out with big debts but no better job prospects.
Mm-hmm.
But what's fascinating about this with older people, and you're talking about retiring post-war babies, the participation rates of people 65 to 74 have gone up.
Still pretty good, right?
They're lower than younger people, but they're going up. And over 75. Now, why is that? Two reasons. One is people are in better health. They're living longer. They want to stay active.
For sure.
But also, a lot of people simply do not have the assets to retire.
Right.
So you're getting some very interesting dynamics within that. But the bottom line is there are a lot of people out there. Now, training having the skills to take jobs, that's another issue. But if you assume if you get people properly trained, there's really no shortage of labor in the foreseeable future.
Huh, that's amazing. So let's talk along related lines. Let's talk about productivity gains and indirectly automations. What is the impact of, like in my office, I know we're six, seven, we're now seven people, we're about to be eight people. I know that to do what we do 30 years ago would have taken 50 people. And thanks to computer technology and software, each person does. We don't have a bookkeeper. We outsource that to an accountant who looks at stuff quarterly, who sees everything online. A lot of the stuff that we used to do with an assistant and a secretary, that's all automatic. It's all done on the everybody types. It's not like you can be an executive who doesn't type.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so you're entering everything into the computer. And then when you look at different tools, like what we get from Salesforce as an example, as a sales management, a CRM tool, that would have been somebody's full-time job. And now it's one piece of software for eight people. It's amazing how much more productive each of us are. What does that do to job creation?
Well, you know, the whole idea of industrialization, ever since the Industrial Revolution started in England and New England in the late 1700s, was that it destroys a lot of jobs. You know the origin of the word saboteur? Okay. Sabot, it comes from sabot, which were wooden shoes. Mm-hmm. And early in the Industrial Revolution, the workers who wore wooden shoes would grind them in the machines, wreck the machines, because it was putting people out of work.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to go back to hand weavers. In other words, you've always had this specter of the destruction of jobs by automation. But what has happened, of course, it's created more jobs,
mm-hmm.
and higher level jobs and higher pay jobs with more productivity, and that's the basis of living standards. We've come to a bit of a gap recently with globalization. That's one of the reasons I think globalization is so important, because it's given you this huge gap. In other words, more rather than a gradual increase in this transfer and upgrading and so on and getting rid of the secretaries and the in-house accountants and all the stuff you mentioned, that's happened overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And it has simply left a lot of people in the U.S. and other Western economies who simply are not making that transition. And
not prepared to adapt.
And it may be a generational deal. And I don't think it's the end of the world, but it is almost a quantum shift there because of globalization.
So you mentioned that as we've gone through the industrial era and as we've seen more and more heavy manufacturing put people out of work but at the same time create other jobs, when we look at technology, especially biotech, internet, computer technology, the amount of job loss that's created, is that really going to be offset by new and related jobs in that space? Because that's the big concern of a lot of people, is that there are people who are creating software, creating technology that allows each person to do so much more. You've eliminated a huge swath of jobs.
Well, the jobs are being created. Just where are they geographically? In other words, are they in this country or are they in China, and now low-end manufacturing moving on from China to lower-cost areas, Bangladesh, Vietnam, Pakistan, and so on?
Well, we see the iPhone, which is designed in the United States,
right.
Designed in San Francisco, but essentially it's manufactured in China with components and other parts made all over the world, but the bulk of which are in low-cost countries.
That's right.
So what is and yet there's also an app economy where all these software designers and all these people are making a whole run of different software to put on that work pretty much anywhere, but they're mostly the United States, Europe, India, Japan, places like that. So is that technology creating more jobs than it destroys?
It's creating more jobs, and of course, it's adding to income polarization, because those are
better
jobs. Those are high skilled jobs. Those are high paid jobs. But what you've eliminated are these, you know, auto factories in this country that employ 5,000 people. That's out. Now, one of the interesting things coming out of this, and particularly with what's going on right now, we've had 8 years of basically no real income growth in the U.S. and really Europe, Japan, the developed world. In other words, mm-hmm. adjusted for inflation, no growth. People get frustrated after a while of that. And what's happening? We're beginning to see that expressed politically. For example, in France, the National Front, headed by this woman, Marie Le Pen, she may be the next president of France. It's a very...
You may end up with Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump in the United States.
In the U.S. And of course, John Boehner, you know. In other words...
Finally said he'd had enough and he's done.
There's this reaction to politicians in the center and looking at the fringes. U.K., the head of the new head of the Labor Party. I mean, you're getting very interesting expressions of this. And of course, you know, we're not talking about French revolutions now where people out there tear down the Bastille, but it is a similar kind of impulse, and we could get some very interesting political ramifications.
So we just saw that in Greece with Tsipras getting
reelected.
Well,
you got a far right and a far left coalition.
Although I will tell you the craziest thing, so we're recording this in the beginning of fall 2015. So we don't know the outcome of the election for any of you in the future listening to this. We don't know a lot of things. But one of the things that I find fascinating is when you look at the shocking and sudden rise of Donald Trump, politically, he's much more centrist than either the bulk of the Republicans on the right and the bulk of the Democrats on the left. I'm amazed that when you strip away the bluster, he's kind of a centrist, old school politician. Who would have saw that coming a few years ago?
Yeah, but it's a hell raising aspect. It's like, what was that movie, Network News, where the guy goes, you know, I'm not going to take it anymore.
Mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean,
Network.
It's that same kind of reaction, and that's what he's about. Bernie Sanders. I mean, of course, he's way to the left, but it's that same kind of appeal. It's kind of a saying, the centrist politicians have not solved the problems. We got to do something else, and there's a big hearing for that kind of thing. So this is a kind of a cycle within the cycle, if you want to use cycles. And we talked about mm-hmm. whether they're relevant or not. But you've had globalization going on for about three decades, but now in the aftermath of the global Great Recession, 2007-2009, we're having this period of slow growth. It's I call it the age of deleveraging. No growth in real incomes, mm-hmm. and as a result, I think the combination of these things is putting a lot of pressure on the political system, and the conventional politicians really don't know how to react to this.
So let me ask you a question about that. I'm not sure where I pulled this number from, but there was some news article out not too long ago that said the middle class has not seen in real terms, I forget nominal terms, but in real terms, has not really seen wage gains since 1973.
I think that's probably valid. Yeah,
if you look at
real wages and that pretty much is that category.
Because their insurance costs are up, and their
median real family income. That's what those statistics show you. And the growth has come on the top. There's a lot of income redistribution to people on the bottom. And people can say, oh, this is terrible. And of course, the Pope is. That was his theme as well. But, you say if you have rapid growth, if you have a dynamic economy, it is going to sort out the people who have the skills in order to participate. You look at China. Look how many billionaires there are in China. And you say, but this is a country with an average income of, about a sixth of what we have.
Right.
But yet, when you see dynamic
$8,000.
Growth, the people who take it, now you can say, that's not equitable distribution, but that's a judgment call. That's not a market call.
So what does the United States need to do to sort of restart that economic engine and go from, forget 5%, how about going from 2% to over 3%?
Well, I think to a certain extent it's really just a matter of having patience and letting this whole age of deleveraging run its course.
Now, once people are no longer buried with debt they picked up in the last cycle,
that's right. And
activity
picks
up.
I'm convinced after that we are going to see a return to rapid growth, and it will be led by technology and productivity.
So you're for a guy who says the bond bull market is still here, you're fairly optimistic.
Oh, I am in the long run, very much so. And one of the reasons is my basic philosophy. Right now, the easy long-term forecast to sell is slow growth forever.
Right.
Because everybody looks around and says, that's what I see. Right on, brother. You look at people like Bob Gordon, professor at Northwestern.
Mm-hmm.
He's going around saying everything that is really productive that's worth inventing has been invented. Modern
By the way, we've heard that throughout the centuries, and it's always been wrong.
Modern Malthusian. And it sells very well. Neil Ferguson at Harvard, things are being dragged down by regulation and so on. Larry Summers, demographic.
Ferguson should stick to history. He's a terrible economic commentator. Every time he talks about economics, he manages to get something
majorly wrong. His native field. But what I'm saying, Barry, is that that's the easy sell. And,
it's appealing.
I'm always looking for, where's the hidden flaw? That's how I made my career, is looking for why is it going to go wrong? And in this case, for example, they say that Gordon says that the internet and so on is finished. Computers, it's all realized. I think those things are more in their infancy than they are fully
developed. I couldn't agree more.
I mean, just to give you a couple of examples. The American Industrial Revolution started in the late 1700s, grew like Topsy, but it didn't get big enough to move the economy until after the Civil War. I mean,
75 years later.
Yeah. Railroads, again, they started late 1700s, not until the latter half of the 19th century. I mean, it takes a long time for these things. And, you look at, you and I have a cell phone. I mean, this has got more computer power than an IBM 360, this little gadget in your pocket.
I jokingly tell people there's more computing power on this than took man to the moon with the lunar
program. It really is. And I was looking, I was taking some pictures, and here I am on our beach house here, or, at home around it. I've got just where it records where it is. I mean, you say Big Brother knows where you are. But
that's a setting. You can either turn that off or leave it on.
My opinion that we are more in the infancy than we are finished on these new technology. Biotechnology, I think, is much, much more in its infancy and what that is going to do for productivity growth in the future. Now, again, you got to have people who have the right training. But, one of the problems we have in this country country, and it's just a different topic, but I think related, is the education system.
For sure.
And we have the attitude, that everybody ought to go to college, and it is true that people with college educations make more than high school grads, but you can't prove causality with statistics. I guarantee you, positively, absolutely, every time there's a total eclipse of the sun, if you go outside and beat a drum, it will go away. 100% correlation, no causality.
Right.
The reality is, in my view, smart people go to college, but college doesn't make you smart. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to recognize that and say, okay, there are a lot of people who can have very credible jobs. Hey, what's the last time you hired a plumber to clean out a toilet and he charged you $100 for 15 minutes work?
Right.
I mean, there are a lot of jobs that are not college educations, but they're certainly very credible. There's 600,000, estimates are there's 600,000 jobs going begging now for people with computer skills to work in factories. And one of the things that's happening to solve that is the Germans. They have a very strong apprenticeship program history. They brought a lot of their plants into the southeast of this country, and they have these apprenticeship programs combined with two-year community college degrees. Mm-hmm. And these guys come out, and they're very well paid. And American companies are emulating that same kind of thing. So I think that's one of the most exciting things in education. It just isn't saying everybody. And we have a college for any intellectual capability in this country. Look at the for-profit colleges. Absolute disaster.
Total debacle.
They wouldn't exist without government subsidies, and it is just a waste of money.
Oh, they came about on their own to beginning. There was a huge movement for the private sector can do this on their own, and once they figured out they could suckle off the teat of Uncle Sam, they were all over it.
Oh, sure.
And they're
a
debacle.
Sure,
now.
And, as an entrepreneur, okay, why not?
Because we know where it ultimately ends up.
It's making the money the old-fashioned way. Skill, luck, clairvoyance, brains, hard work, and so much government subsidy you can't miss.
Right.
Until
they collapse under their own weight. So you're really a pretty optimistic guy about the future of America.
I am. I think we've got to get through this. This deleveraging.
How long does it last?
If you look at the Reinhardt-Rogoff data,
for you to go there.
It goes 10 years. Now, that data is over centuries. It's developed countries. It's banana republics. It's a lot of apples and oranges.
How about recently in developed countries?
But right now, recently, if you go back to the 30s, it was about 10 years. Mm-hmm. We're 8 years into this now. At the rate we're going, it may take longer than another 2 years to complete. Mm-hmm. but I'm convinced it will be.
12 years, 15 years? Give me a number.
Maybe something in that. Yeah, if you use a straight line, the financial sector in this country's probably got another 5 or 6 years to go. The consumer working off excess debt's probably maybe a little bit longer, maybe 7, 8 years. Mm-hmm. But that's just drawing straight lines on
So you're
on
guessing we're halfway through
yeah,
the deleveraging
I would guess,
process.
I would guess so. And as I mentioned earlier, one of the really interesting questions is the electorate going to have the patience to go through this, or are we going to get a reaction? Are we going to get some oddballs in Congress, the administration? Are we going to see a big push for government stimulus?
Mm-hmm.
And if we do, I think it'll be fiscal. It won't be monetary.
We've exhausted the monetary
stimulus
at this
point. On the string.
That's the traditional. Listen, following the Great Depression, even following the 2000 recession, we saw a huge surge of fiscal stimulus.
Yeah.
That's been more or less missing this go round. What would the impact of that be to the deleveraging process?
Well, I don't know that it would necessarily reverse it. I mean, but it could mitigate it.
It could speed it up a little bit.
Yeah, it could speed it up.
I just want my roads paved. People accuse me of being, you're a big government guy. No, I'm tired of replacing axles. I want, my run flat tires show up as flat because there are so many potholes.
Well, that's a big difference between monetary and fiscal policy. Monetary policy is a very blunt instrument.
Mm-hmm.
The Fed and other central banks can raise and lower interest rates. They can buy and sell securities. That's it.
Right.
And beyond that, the chips fall where
they may. And you don't really see that immediately.
Yeah, the chips fall where they may. Fiscal policy can be pinpointed. If you want to improve the roads, you put money into road construction.
Right.
If you want to help the unemployed, you increase unemployment benefits. It can be very, very specific. It doesn't say it's going to be efficient. It doesn't say it's going to be.
Our electrical grid to be upgraded.
It's
terrible. It'd be nice if our ports were secure. We know that they're still vulnerable to foreign or terrorist attack.
Well, you and I are on the same page there. I think infrastructure is really.
And
is
if you
really
go, if you travel to Asia or Europe, our cellular system is awful. And our broadband, where we essentially created this technology, we're now the back of the. But we are terrible compared.
Forget
Korea, who kicks our butt. Most of Europe is 3 to 5 times faster than us and cheaper.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
All right, so I know I only have you for a few more minutes. Let me go through some of my favorite questions to ask people, and we'll get you out of here on time.
Okay.
So before you came to Wall Street, you mentioned you were working for Standard Oil. What did you do for them? What was your pre-Wall Street experience?
Like? I was an economist there. They had what was called a general economics department. They had economists that covered various segments of the world. I was in charge of the U.S. and Canada in terms of forecasting and analysis of the economy. And that was a time when the major corporations, they had two things they knew they had to have. You couldn't go to lunch with your fellow CEOs and other wizards without having them,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't know what to do with either one. And one was economists and the other was computers.
That's fascinating. So from that you decided?
From that I decided... And Standard Oil was a huge company, obviously well-run company. It's going to be there forever, but it was fairly bureaucratic, and I wanted something a little more active, and that's why I went left for Wall Street.
So let's talk a little bit about some of your early mentors. Who really influenced you mentioned the professor at Amherst who impacted your career, clearly a mentor. Who else was a mentor of yours? Who influenced your thinking?
I'm not sure I could name. I thought about that earlier. We talked about that, and I'm not sure I could mention. I never, for better or worse, Barry. I don't think I ever had the mentor.
So let me rephrase that question slightly differently. What books throughout your lifetime have you found especially influential?
I guess some of the basic books on the economy but I think it's been more the philosophical aspects and some of the great thinkers who
give us some examples. You mentioned Milton Friedman earlier.
Yeah,
certainly. I know you don't agree with everything he said.
Well, Keynes had a lot of interesting things.
No doubt
say.
About that.
My two thesis advisors at Stanford. Ed Shaw and Jack Early, they came up with the idea that money pervaded in finance and everything had a degree of money, even insurance policies.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say that I really studied under, one great mentor and that made all the difference.
So let's talk about the financial industry. Obviously, a lot has changed since you first joined Wall Street back in the late 60s. What do you think is the most significant shift we've seen in finance over the past 40 years?
It's probably the proliferation of financial instruments. When I got in to Merrill Lynch, and that was in 1967, you had fixed commission rates. Everything was pretty well regimented.
No competition.
No real competition as we know it today. Regulation. I mean, they even had fixed retail prices. You couldn't go into a store and buy, couldn't buy a tube of toothpaste where the price wasn't fixed in many cases.
I think what's happened is, first of all,
you have opened things up with allowing competition, starting with May Day and the fixed commission rates in 1975. And then also the proliferation of computers and ability to trade and moving away from individual securities. I remember at Merrill Lynch, their trading operation, it looked like a racetrack where they had these belts that went around in a big U, and a guy would take an order and he'd stick it in this track and would go around to the guy on the other side who would process it. I mean,
now you push a button and it's instant.
I mean, museum. And not only that, we're at the point now where these guys want to be, it's so fast that they want to be as short a distance physically.
Right.
From
the, now, the high frequency
traders.
186,000
miles a second. Okay. But they want to be half a mile closer.
The
electrons don't travel that fast. But, that kind of thing has really.
If you remember the beginning of The Big Short, if you met that book by Michael Lewis, they talk about all of these high frequency trading brokerage firms that locate just outside of the Holland Tunnel.
Yeah, right.
So they're the closest to the feed. From Wall Street.
That's exactly what I'm
talking
about.
These guys from Chicago laying a fiber optic cable in a dead straight line, didn't care what was in the way. Mountains, houses, buy it and blow through it. And now they're replacing that with, over the air microwave point to point broadcast. So you don't even have to lay fiber optic. You can just go, you have to have a series of jumps because the curvature of the earth gets in the way. But that's how important speed was to those guys.
Yeah. And the question is, are we able to handle this in terms of the effects of this? And we've seen this with, 87 stock market nosedive. S&P was down 22% in one day. We've seen it with flash crashes in
2010,
stocks and bonds.
And more recently, we saw that with the ETF crash.
Right. And the question is, are we really up to speed with this? And then you have a much better question, and this goes back to a lot of what we talked about automation and so on. Has that made us any better decision makers? I'll tell you one book that I always read, it's a whole bunch of them, it's Shakespeare. I'm a great fan of Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
And you go back and you say, first of all, that guy said things in an elegant way that none
amazing.
Of us,
right.
The best line I've ever written.
He's going to be big one day.
Worse than the worst line he ever wrote. But you look at these and you say, has anything really changed? Are we making any better decisions with all this technology and speed? I'm not sure we have. And does this mean that it's given us more confidence that we're going bad and with more confidence than before? I mean, because you think, all that data is available and so on. So I'm not sure that we're able to synthesize that data any better. And of course, everybody else has the same data. And are you any better off, really, in terms of forecast? You're a forecaster. I'm a forecaster. Are we making better forecasts than we did 20 years ago?
I am, but it feels to me that all this technology and all this high speed, not specialists, not people who have an obligation to make an orderly market, it makes it feel like the market structure is a little less stable or a lot less stable.
Well, I think that's true. And you really say, is that go with the territory? And you just have to expect these periodic glitches and the puke point. You reach that occasionally.
That's right.
It's just part of the whole deal, and you live with it. And I say that's part of the deal. But you know, the thing about finance is, finance fundamentally, the justification for finance is to grease the wheels of commerce.
Mm-hmm.
It's if we had a barter system, it would be pretty rough.
Right. Too much friction in every transaction.
And that's what finance is. But I think finance, and particularly leading up to the collapse in 2008, a lot of those guys felt they were an end to themselves. Mm-hmm. And their only job was to make money. And they didn't really think about, are we contributing anything? Are we improving productivity? Are we making it possible for investments to get productive things done in the economy? And I think there's a lot of sight been lost of what the ultimate objective of finance is.
I couldn't agree more. So that's historically looking back. Let me ask you next question. What do you see as the next important shifts in finance going forward?
Oh gosh, it's probably got to do with globalization.
So no more, less of an impact of national borders than you have currently.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, the technology is there, and yet you still have separate regulations, separate exchanges. There's a lot of particularly in Europe, where they're trying to combine this, but on a global basis. But you know, when money can move around at the touch of a keystroke. The idea that you're moving into different regulatory jurisdictions, because guys are always going to try to game the system. They're going to look for the lowest regulatory climate. And I think that's probably something that we're going to see is a lot more global control of financial flows. Not control in the sense of big brother, but just common regulations so that it's all under the same regulatory framework.
So we're down to my last two favorite questions, and let me ask you this. So the millennials, the people just graduating college who we were discussing earlier, if one of them approached you and said, Gary, I'm interested in a career in finance, what advice can you give me? What would you tell them?
other than to become a great economist, of course. I would probably advise them to try to find an area where you are doing something that's productive, and you're not just a glorified shuffler of paper. Trading is important. It lubricates the system, but trading just for the sake of making money. I mean, you look at corporate finance.
Mm-hmm.
If you go back, take Goldman Sachs. That used to be an investment banking house, and their job was to work with clients and to raise money for them to do investments and productive things, and it was a win-win situation. The client got the issue placed. Investors were satisfied with it most of the time, and the investment banker got a fee. Okay. Now what Wall Street is involved in is trading houses.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't a win-win situation. It's a zero-sum game.
Right. There's a winner and a loser. It's not like the pie is getting bigger.
Yeah.
It's just how it's
now,
divided.
Now, I don't think, if I were advising somebody, I'd say, I don't think you ought to be in that zero-sum game business, because I don't think it's, whether it just makes a lot of money for you and you move to the Hamptons and so on,
but it's not fulfilling and it's not productive.
But I'm not sure how sustainable that is.
Mm-hmm. And then my final question: what is it that you know about investing and finance and economics today that you wish you knew when you began way back in the 1960s?
It's probably a lot more respect for the unknowns out there and the vicissitudes of nature and the realization that the best laid plans of mice and men gang off a galley, that you can have a great forecast and all the fundamentals fall into place and markets just simply do not confirm it. And the way I put it is, markets can remain irrational a lot longer than we can remain solvent.
I've heard that somewhere. Well, Gary, thank you so much. This has been a delight. If people want to find your newsletter or your research, how do they go about tracking you down?
Well, they can track us down. It's our website, www.agaryschilling.com.
And you now have a Twitter handle, I noticed.
Oh, yes. Oh, of course. And you got to have that.
And it's the same, @AGarySchilling.
Right, right.
Fantastic.
Right.
Well, thank you for spending so much time with us today. You've been listening to Masters in Business. If you enjoy this conversation, look up an inch or down an inch on iTunes and you'll see the other 60 or so podcasts we've had. Let me make sure to say thank you to my head of research, Mike Batnick, and my producer, Charlie Vollmer. Be sure and check out all the rest of our other interviews. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.